listening in as well. So, first of all, I want to see if the operator is on the line. Operator, are you on the line?
I am on the line.
Good. Could you mute the call so I can so we can have people start queuing up?
The lines are muted.
All right. Thank you. Okay. So, we have some new mastery students. I want to welcome to the call from New Jersey and New York. Welcome. You're in the right place. Just simply follow the system, follow what your coach says, and 14 years of experience and 14 years of results, and you can't go wrong. So also, a reminder to Mastery students about the Ultimate Partnering 9 video testimonial contest. We're having a full one-day consulting with me for the best testimonial clip that you can put together. So be working on that. We got a couple of high fives here. First high five is for Dave Willis and also for Chris Ufamada. I hear something. My phone ringing. And their partners out of Houston, Texas, they recently closed on a 10-unit property. The purchase price was under $200,000. They found two investors to invest in the deal. They were able to get a 3.75% acquisition fee. That's nice. The value play is that the property needs some work. Chris is a contractor and is going to do most of it. Rents are low, another value play. And they'll be putting a management company in place. And they just started in February. So congratulations. High five to you two. One and two. And then also to Steve Firestone from Boca Raton, Florida. Steve's a mastery student who recently closed on a 209-unit property in Atlanta. Yes? Hey, Jeff, come on in.
I think they're a little too close to that mic. They're a little choppy.
Too choppy?
Yeah. But you're talking really loud.
Come over here.
I can't hear unless you're on my phone.
Yeah, but come over here. I want to introduce everybody to my brother, Jeff. For those of you that aren't familiar with him, he runs the Mastery Program.
Right.
Yeah, and also the Immersion Training.
That's right.
Yeah. He's just telling me that the this is the first time we're live streaming, so we're going to run into some technical stuff that we weren't sure of going in. But he's telling me that the microphone is a little bit too close and it's coming out a little bit fuzzy. So I'm just going to hold that to the side a little bit. So let's get back to Steve Firestone, who closed on 209 units in Atlanta, which will put him over the 1,000-unit mark. Congratulations to Steve. The purchase price was $8.5 million. He raised $3.2 million through private money investors. The property already has strong cash flow in place, but there's a potential for additional value plays, which are that the rents are below market, and he's looking to put in a RUB system, resident utility billing system, and also adding another laundry room. So it states that these value adds could increase the value by over $2 million. So cash flow increases value increases cash flow increases the value of the property. So congratulations. So if you're new to the call, what you want to do is you want to press star zero, and that will cue you up, and that will get you into the call. So press star zero, and then you'll get into the queue, and the operator will ask your name, and then you can ask questions for the next hour or so. I'm going to be answering questions. The best I can, they can be real estate related, which I'm really good at, and they can be life related, which I've had a lot of life experience. So either or is fine with me. I do have some mastery questions that were sent in, and I do have some questions from some additional people. Silver Success is also on the line, so welcome, Silver Success. I'm going to answer some of those questions too. So the first thing here is we're live here in Boston, just south of Boston, about a half an hour. If you haven't come and visited the office, please come feel free to visit us. If you want to give us a heads up, you can. Some people just show up and they just want to make sure that it's really real and surprise us. That'll be fine too. But we've got 12,000 square feet here in our education company and also in our real estate acquisitions company as well. So we're working on a bunch of different things. We've got just recently closed on a deal down in Huntsville. Looking at a deal with some students down there, 200 unit. They're in best and final in. That just was with the – if you're Mastery San Diego – welcome, because Monday night we had a nice a Skype call together. That was a lot of fun. We'll do that again soon. So we're working on those couple of deals. And there's a lot of things going on. But let's go to some questions here, get some content in here. Somebody, Jin He from San Diego, he says he just started a multifamily business, and he says that I say to start in your own backyard. But the apartments in his backyard usually have a low cap rate, about 5%, well below the 8% for the Trinity. In this case, we're in a seller's market too, in San Diego, or are we in a seller's market too? And how and where should I start looking for deals so I can have success? Where's the best place investors like to invest their funds? Well, first of all, I say that you should be starting in your own backyard, and you should also be starting in an emerging market as well. You can get some great experience in your own backyard by being able to talk to brokers, take them out to lunch face-to-face, build your team, your management company, talk to them face-to-face, your attorneys, your accountants. You can go tour properties and tour neighborhoods, you know, with brokers, with management companies. You get a lot of real-world experience right in your own backyard, regardless of what cycle or phase of the cycle that your market is in. You can also use that experience that you're getting in your own backyard to parlay in emerging markets that you're going to be basically talking on the phone to most people until you get over there, until you take a trip over there. So the answer is you should be doing both. I know San Diego is a difficult market right now. There's a lot of yield taken out of the market. A lot of the West Coast cities are East Coast cities as well. But, you know, your relationships are going to determine how well you do in any particular market. And, you know, I forget who the testimonial is. Maybe Jeff can bring it in here. Every Tuesday we have a meeting after this call, actually. And it's a company meeting. And the first thing we talk about is the success of our students. And because our number one core value is that we're not successful until our students are successful. So Jermaine brought up the fact that, I forget which student it was, but just bought a deal in Los Angeles that cash flows. And everything you hear about Los Angeles is that nothing cash flows. But when you have the right relationships, you get the pocket listings. And then you get deals that cash flow regardless of the market. And that's why this is a relationship business, and that's why that's so important. So there were a lot of different questions about which markets to be investing in, not only through the question from Ying, but also from some questions here from Silver Success as well. So you know what I pulled up? I pulled up, get out a pen and paper, because I'm going to give you some of the best markets right now to be investing in. And that is... over. Did you happen to take out the Word document that I had on my computer? Oh, this isn't my computer. Is this my computer? This isn't my computer. What did you do with my computer? Oh, could you grab it for me? So we're not using my computer, actually. I just got back from lunch. I have that document. We'll go through those top. I got it right here, actually. I just printed it out. I printed it out before I went to lunch. Thanks. All right, so I've got it right here. So some of the best emerging markets right now: Columbia, South Carolina, Dayton, Ohio, Las Vegas, Wilmington, Delaware, Jackson, Mississippi, which it's, that market will never appreciate the way you think it's going to. That was advice that was given to me by a mentor many years ago. Jacksonville, Florida, St. Louis, Greensville, South Carolina, though that market's a little long in the tooth. Cleveland, Ohio, Tulsa, Cape Coral. The area between Cape Coral and Jacksonville is really good right now. Lexington, Kentucky, horse farms. Barrier to entry in that particular market. It's all full of surrounded by horse farms, which is good. Boise, Idaho. Another thing I always like to mention is the Milken Report, which I look at a lot. And the Milken Report will give you the best performing cities for the previous year. And some of the markets that have moved the most inside of the Milken Report are Albany, New York, Providence, Rhode Island, Stockton, California, Port St. Lucie, Florida, Visalia, California, Salem, Oregon, Olympia, Washington, Tacoma, and Riverside. So there you go. That answers quite a few questions that came in. So press *0. *0 will get you to the operator. The operator will get you in on the call. And also, I got another question. And this one comes in from Will Beck from Dallas. Will says, okay, so Jose Belro, looks like. Is that right? Yep, Jose Belro is doing deals in California, in Los Angeles, Oakland, and San Mateo, the cash flow. Right on, Jose. Oh, there's a high five for you. I didn't give a high five to Mr. Firestone either. High five for Mr. Firestone. Excellent. All right, so Will Beck writes in. He says he's getting good deal flow in Texas, especially Dallas and Houston. And the panhandle, every once in a while it comes across a property that he can make good money by flipping the contract. How have you done this in the past? He's run into a couple issues: assignment fees and back-to-back closings, transactional funding fees. Well, with commercial properties, inside your letter of intent, it states that you can assign that contract out. And the reason being is, with commercial properties, it's rule of thumb that you put the property under contract from your umbrella entity, and then you assign it over to the entity that's actually going to hold the property, because each one of your properties is owned in a different entity. So it's right in your, it should be right in your letter of intent. And if you're using the letter of intent from the boot camp, it's in there. So you don't have to do, you can typically assign it over. You don't do back-to-back closing, but you just sign it over to the new buyer. In the contract inside of the, at the boot camp, if you remember that it states in there that the seller has the, in order for the agreement to be assigned, that the seller has to be notified in writing of the assignment. You take that out when you're buying a property. You keep that in when you're selling a property. We never buy and sell the same way. Okay. Can you put a syndication fee in there somehow for the when you're signing it out? No, you're basically going to get your assignment fee. All right. I think I answered that one. All right, operator. Who's our first caller today?
Okay. First question comes from Carlos. Carlos, please go ahead.
Carlos? I can't hear Carlos. Can you?
Hello, everyone.
Yeah. Oh, hey, Carlos. What's happening? Doing good. What's going on? Carlos from Miami?
No, Carlos from New Jersey.
Oh, Carlos from New Jersey. Okay.
Hi, how are you? No, nothing much. I just went to the seminar this weekend. Just a little eager to, looking for emerging market and... just wanted to see, I know what you just said about Port St. Lucie, Rhode Island, and all these other ones. Is there any way, maybe through email, we can get a list just to look where to look a little more?
Yeah, just call over. There should be, inside the Mastery website, there's an area where we keep the top markets.
Okay.
And if not, if you can't find it, then just email over to Jermaine, Jeff, or Jeannie, and they'll tell you where it is, or they'll send you out the list that I just mentioned.
Okay, great. No, that's it. I'm just happy to be in and, ready to get some deals.
All right. Well, just follow the system. Which you were just at the event last weekend?
Yes, this weekend, yep.
Oh, welcome aboard. Welcome aboard. Just
okay.
Take small steps and, at the end of a month and then 6 months, you'll be there.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. One thing I wanted to mention was Steve Firestone. When he first started out, he came to Ultimate Partnering 8. One of the next event that we have coming up is Ultimate Partnering 9, which we've had 9 different events. If you've been to them, you know how great they are. It's an event where there's anywhere. Last year, it was 725 people. This year, there should be over 1,100, the way the numbers are tracking right now. It's basically an event where we educate you additionally about investing in commercial properties. But we also, it's a big networking event. So we've been teaching now for 14 years. We've got students that have done very well. They come back to the event. It's the new event of the year. It's an event that, it's new, it's fresh. Most of the older students have been to the other events. They've gone out there and they've done very well, and they're looking to partner with other people in deals. They're looking to become money partners. So you can find money partners there. You can find deal partners there. You can find partners, business partners there. So we're really big on the networking. We do speed networking there. We do networking at the end of the days. We make it very easy to network so you can meet people. So you're going to bring a lot of cards. The very first day with the before 12 o'clock, you will have met, a good portion of the people in the room through this thing, what we call speed networking. You get 15 seconds, they get 15 seconds. You talk about what you're looking for. If you're a match, you keep their card. If you're not, you just move on to the next one. Then you get your targets for the next 3 days. If you want to learn more about that event, go to ultimatepartnering9.com, ultimatepartnering9.com. And that's where Steve Firestone and Carl Withers and a lot of other people raise their money to fund their deals. Who's our next caller? That's in August, by the way.
Okay.
No, that's in July, last weekend of July. I'm just coming off 2 weeks of a really nasty cold. I thought I'd get rid of it after the first week, and then the second week, I somehow got it again. So it got me even harder. And actually, today's I'm a little nasally, but today's the first day I actually feel good. So who's our next caller? I'm going to actually answer go ahead. Send up the next one. I'm going to answer a few questions in between.
Okay. Up next, we have Stephanie. Stephanie, please go ahead.
Hello, Dave.
Stephanie.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Oh. How's it going?
I'm well, thank you. I had the same cold, Dave, but I finally feel much better. And I just wanted to chime in on UP8. Last year was my first time actually attending. It was fabulous.
Yeah.
Everyone that I've met in your program who hasn't attended, I've encouraged to attend that and also the sponsorship event. So I recommend them very highly.
So you went there. Did you meet a lot of people?
I met a tremendous amount of people.
How easy was it to network? I mean, how easy did we make it for you to meet people?
Well, that's what I try to express to everyone, that you very expertly set the stage such that people feel comfortable about networking. It's almost as if it's expected because of the way that you set everyone up in the morning. You clearly state that this is what you're expected to do, so we're all there with the right mindset, and then the speed networking really facilitates that. I thought it was just absolutely fabulous. Because you meet so many people, and you're going there, you're trying to, you know, I had sufficient number of cards, and I was noting which areas or what they were interested in, and then you could systematically follow back up with them to the extent you wanted to. So I thought it was fabulous.
Good. Well, thanks for saying that. I appreciate it.
Yes.
UP9 is going to be great. They just
I'm
get
excited.
Bigger
I'm already registered. Yeah, exactly. I'm excited. So, Dave, I'm really close on a deal. And I, the seller and I are about 50 off, and I finally went up to the seller's price. I think that there's value there. It's a portfolio opportunity, so it doesn't fully meet the Trinity, but it's pretty close. I would be satisfied as a personal investor in the deal. The thing that I did, though, was I had been having a lot of conversations with the property manager that I'm considering bringing on, and ultimately I just decided to ask him if he would be willing to partner with me on this deal, because he had also looked at the deal at a lower price, but for various reasons decided to not to move forward, and he said that he might be interested. I wanted to just get your advice on what I should be thinking about in terms of crafting a JV relationship, especially if it's with the potential future property manager.
The first thing you think about is the divorce. In case something happens, you know, partnerships don't always last, so you got to be prepared for that. You got to get a good attorney that knows how to create a good LLC or partnership agreement. But you want to be looking at what the exit strategies are in case it doesn't go right. You also have to have something in there, you know, performance. It's not guaranteed that they're going to keep the management. If they're not performing on management, you know, then they should be expected to give up the management to another company. So those are the two biggest issues I think you're walking into.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And any suggestions on the split in terms of ownership interest if the property?
How much money are they putting down? How much money are you putting down?
We haven't done
in
the numbers
terms of
yet,
percentage.
But I'm expecting 75-25.
You're going to put up 75, they're going to put up 25?
Possibly, yeah, or 60-40. They haven't told me their full number yet.
You know, the most logical thing to do would be to split it by the amount of the money that each party brings to the table if there's only two of you.
Right. And then what about the management fee, though? That's independent of their
Yeah, that would be independent.
Interest, or...
you know, just figure out what is typically in the area. What size is it? How many units?
It's 32.
It's probably going to be 10% management fee for that size property, 10% of revenues.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, great. So then keep the management fee out and then just split it according to the capital that we both invest.
Yeah. Yeah, the management and the equity side are two different things. You got to treat it like that. So, yeah, they're managing the property as the management company, one. So you actually are hiring them as well as they're hiring themselves on the equity side. And at the same time, you know, you both have an equity position. So you've got to just make sure that's clear at the beginning, that particular person is playing two different roles. And, and he'll always be an equity partner, but there's no guarantee he'll always be a manager. Do you know what I mean?
Okay, exactly.
Get a form. So, yeah, just make that clear at the beginning.
Okay. Yep. And what about subordinating some of the management fee?
What do you mean?
Meaning that, let's say it's 10% is standard, as you were saying. Instead of charging the property 10%, let's say the property was charged 6%, and the additional 4% would come out once they achieved a certain performance hurdle.
Oh, why? What's the problem with the property?
No, there's no problem with the property. It's just in order to improve the cash flow, the free cash flow for the property. Right now, the property's going to be in the area about 8%.
I would rather pay the going rates and then bonus upon hitting certain hurdles than take it back, because nobody wants to work for less than they think they're worth, you know. And if that's what it would be, even if they weren't the partner, I mean, I don't think you would get a management company to take that on property And usually, you know what happens is management companies, when they take on a property that's not performing, they actually require that you pay them a minimum until it gets to the minimum, and then, you know, they get a percentage of revenues after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be a little careful. You want to be really careful when you're dealing with the management companies. You certainly want to pay them what they're worth or what the going rate is, because you don't ever want them to think that, you know, they're getting less than what they should, and you don't want them in the mindset of trying to find out how they're going to make that up somewhere on the property. Do you know what I mean?
I understand.
Through high bills, through contractors paying them off of work. You know, there's a lot of different types of things that management companies can do to get extra money. You don't want them thinking
in that frame. Okay. Thank you. Feel better.
Yeah, thank you. I will. All right. Let's see. I got a couple questions that came in. I actually had a lot of questions. Some of them were single family based. You know, we're a multifamily commercial company. I do a lot of single family stuff, but primarily is we're a multifamily company. A question is seller financing. How and in what situations is this beneficial to a seller financing, and when do they have to report the sale to the IRS or claim the income? So when does seller financing benefit a seller? It's typically when they have a very high tax, they're in a high tax bracket or happen to be in a high tax bracket that particular year. They don't want to have to claim all that income, so they want to push it off. That's the biggest. And then maybe there's a seller that wants an annuity. They want to get monthly payments because, you know, they're selling. Maybe this is their one big deal, and they're selling it. They like the cash flow that the deal was giving, but they didn't like the management or the asset management that they were doing on the deal. So they want that annuity coming in. So those are the two main reasons. And the IRS recognizes that money when it comes in. So you're pushing off. They're pushing off their tax burden. There was a really long question from Sam, and I'm going to get to the bottom of it. And he says, been a multifamily boot camp. More info than I can handle, he says. But he goes on to say, if you want to get an FHA loan, which requires a minimum of 85% occupancy, for a value add, which would be a 65 to 70% occupancy, you'll need a bridge loan, which is usually a hard money lender. The problem is if you have to do a value add that can take about a year or two to achieve, you are then paying off this bridge loan in the interim. Seems pretty long and expensive. In this case, would this scenario be solvent when yes or when not? Well, here's the deal, Sam. No matter what type of leverage you put on a property, whether it be senior debt, secondary debt, tertiary debt, you know, whatever the debt stack is or the capital stack is on a property, that property has to cash flow properly in order to support it. So you're looking or you need to know what your break-even number is to get to break-even and the cash flow, and know that you've got enough reserves in order to get to that particular point. The two number one reasons why properties under 85%, which are typically called repositionings, the two reasons that repositionings fail are the ownership running out of money, running out of reserves, and hiring the wrong management company. And if you hire yourself or hire somebody that's not experienced turning around a property like this, because there's a lot of little things, you know, that could go wrong and right in doing this, but there's a lot of things that you don't know and you don't know about until you actually experience. You know, you hear the expression, you don't know what you don't know. Well, you don't know what you don't know until you start getting involved in these types of deals. The biggest mistake I made was a property that I bought in Huntsville, bought a 400-unit property. And I thought, you know, I had done over 800 units, smaller properties for myself, for Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae when I was their lead contractor. And I thought, oh, this isn't going to be a problem. Well, when you put those 800 units, you know, or half of that in one particular property, there's a lot that you don't know until you experience. And that property took me 6 years to finally get off my plate. And that was 6 years that I could have spent a lot of energy you know, getting better deals that cash flowed. So in terms of a situation like this, you know, Fannie Mae has a really good program where they will you can get a type of a bridge type of a financing that they offer to get into a deal that's below 85% occupancy, okay, bridge or mezzanine. And then as you progress to 85% occupancy, they will then refinance into a conventional loan for a lot less cost than if you did like FHA or some other type of financing. Now, I know the benefits of FHA, which, you know, you can have a 35 or 40 year mortgage. The principal interest payments are a lot less, but there's a lot more demands on the FHA, number one. And number two, it takes like 9 months to get one of those deals done. You have to have a seller that is willing to go the full 9 months. And even though they say it could take 6 months, it never takes 6 months. It always takes about 9 months to do an FHA deal. So you're better off, I think, going through the Fannie Mae program and then going through the break-even analysis. If you're a Mastery student, you go to the Mastery website, and I spend about 40 minutes doing what's called the break-even analysis, taking a property that's at, say, 55% occupancy, and then all the different calculations you need to go through and where to get the information to determine what your break-even is actually going to be. I do it for you now, but just takes a long time. Just go to the Mastery website and go in there and listen to that recording. Actually, I think there's two recordings in there. I did it twice over the years. Okay, so that's them. So let's take another live call. Who's next on the line?
Okay, up next we have Jose.
Who?
Jose, please go ahead.
Hey, how's it going, Dave?
Hey, are you the Jose that's cash flowing in Los Angeles?
Yeah, not really LA, but in California.
Oh, California? Which part?
Yeah, I hope it's the same guy. I'm not sure. Maybe it's another guy. I'm in Northern California.
Oh, okay. I think you are the same guy. When they handed it to me, it said it was, did say LA, but it also said Oakland and one other one.
Yeah, it's probably, did you get that from Jermaine?
Yeah. Oakland, San Mateo,
yeah. In LA. Yep, that's it right there. I got a question for you on a project, potential deal here. It's not in contract, but I'm looking for more of your experience and a little bit more advice on a deal. So it's an old building. It's built in 1939. It has 105 units. Out of the 105, 90 are residential, 15 are office, and retail. So the value add on this deal is that out of the 90 residential, 60 are occupied, 30 are vacant. They're vacant because they need rehab. They're all studios, two bedrooms, one bedrooms, kind of mix around a little bit of combinations. And on the retail, on the 15, on the office ground floor, 50% are occupied, and the same story. They need upgrading and capital. And the seller's selling it because
50% of
the
50% of the retail is occupied.
Yeah.
Okay.
50%. Yeah. It is an older building, but it's a. Yeah. Go ahead, Dave.
Okay. Did you say there was an office involved as well, or is it just retail apartment?
No, it's a combined of both. 90 units out of the 105 are residential, which is the second floor, third, four, five, and six. And then on the ground floor, 15 are retail / office. And half of it is occupied, and 60% is occupied on the residential. So
other than the fact that it needs to be upgraded, why else do you think that it's not fully occupied? Are there buildings around it that are occupied? Is it in a central business district that is declining or stable or growing?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, so it is growing, and the rest of the multifamily apartments, after doing my due diligence and calling around, kind of acting like a tenant, they're all over full. They have waiting lists going on. Now, the reason why this guy is not at its capacity is because, I guess, 5 years ago, I guess it was really run down. They had a lot of druggies and blah, 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 kind of, you know, not the type of tenants that they wanted. And then they upgraded to a new management company. The owners were running it on their own, and they brought in a new management company 3 years ago, and they kind of cleaned it up, and now they got continuous rents, but the owners don't have the money to upgrade the vacancies. So here are the hurdles, and here's what I, or maybe those are some of the hurdles, but it is in downtown. There is like a Starbucks and all these little great shopping centers all around. It's in downtown. Parking, that's the main one. So a lot of these tenants park next to this building on a vacant lot. There's not really parking around because it's in downtown. So the vacant lot belongs to a seller out of in Hawaii. He doesn't know that this building's for sale for what they're telling me because he's going through a divorce. But the building and the cash flow with the bridge loan, I'm negative $1,200 a month. But once it's 90% occupied, I just use the 10% vacancy just to be on the safe side if it were to perform. I'll meet the Trinity or even more. So I got the capital ready, but I just needed your insight on an older building, those scenarios, what should I look for, what else can I do just to kind of, you know, just kind of double check all my T's and X's.
All right. Is it one heating system?
They all have it actually has a centralized system that's been upgraded and also an elevator that's just been upgraded, brand new elevator and brand new HVAC.
Wow, that's good. Both of those were big expenses. Have you talked to any of the tenants? How does the heat flow up to the third floor? Well, usually the third floor is okay. What about the second floor? Even the retail units. You know, have you talked to people about the heat? You talk to anybody about, you know, the condition of the building and what they like and what they don't like about it?
Yeah. So I did one of those things. That's something I learned from Jeff when we did one of those kind of bus tour kind of things. And I talked to one of the
on the immersion training.
Yeah, that was one of the cool thing I learned from it. So I talked.
How was that immersion training with Jeff?
He was all right. He's doing okay. Pretty fun.
He's all right.
Yeah, he's a pretty cool guy. Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, I got everything I – in fact, actually, I might want to take it again. I think it's one of the crucial classes.
Yeah, it is.
So I talked to this guy outside, and he said, you know, I wish there was, like – they would get, like, the cockroaches out. He has a lot of cockroaches. So
inside that building?
Me, like, yeah, inside the building. So that's one thing, and then he says he likes the location, so that's one thing.
How are the windows?
Well, again, it's a historical building. They're all original, so city told me that you have to maintain or upgrade them to keep it historical, because it's a historical building. I guess it's a big deal, the building. So
that's a really big deal, historical, because anything you do on the exterior of the property, a lot, even in the interior, sometimes you've got to go by the specs of the historical society. I would investigate that first, just to make sure you know what the rules are when you're going to go do some rehab on these properties, on that property, and then find out what extra. There is definitely extra expenses included in that. So find out what those extra expenses are going to cost you in doing that. You've got the heating system, and the elevator all taken care of. It seems to be. The parking, if you're at 90% occupied and you couldn't get that lot, say they built on it or you couldn't buy it or somehow they stopped you, is there enough park? You got to determine if there's enough parking outside for your tenants to park. Because if they can't park, you know, it's a pain in the butt. They're coming home with the groceries. They're not going to be living there long, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I asked that question to the
city. That's the issue.
Yeah, so the city told me that that's a concern they have, that they're working on getting some new parking spots downtown. They're kind of revitalizing a lot of it, but I'm not kind of dependent on that. That's why I'm asking you, you know, what about if that doesn't work out and the owner finds out and may leverage and say, hey, I'll sell it to you now for X amount of price. I don't know if that'll work out.
Why don't you get it under contract? You know, subject you could get under contract subject to buying that lot, or you could just get under contract and then investigate buying that lot to see if you can get it. Part of your due diligence process, you know, try to get a 60-day due diligence process, get the lot under contract if you can, you know, see what type of a price, and if it makes sense, you got it, you're all set. And if it doesn't, I'd be really concerned about that parking. The city says it's going to do something, but, you know, cities act really slow. And if your property, you're going to put a bunch of money into a property and it's dependent upon, you know, whether or not they can park, and they can't, you got a problem. Also for that retail space too, you know. That retail needs parking as well. It's not as imperative as the tenants, but it is important depending on who you get in there for businesses. And if you're smart, you get you get businesses in there that things that you can't buy on the internet. And that'll make it more stable.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, Dave. I'm going to use what you gave me, and thank you so much. I'll take this in, and if not, I'll email you guys for more questions and or Craig Picard.
Sounds good, Jose. Good luck
cool.
with that one.
Thank you a lot. All right. Talk to you
All
later.
Right. Bye. Okay, Norman Johnston writes in. He says, is there a company or individual you know that might be able to provide funding or refer me to such a source for the right opportunity? Looking for 100% financing achieved through one or more sources. You can achieve 100% financing through equity partners, and that's what private money is all about. You get the first capital stack from the banks or the lenders, any lender will do. And from there, then you get your equity partners to put in the rest of the money. So typically the deals that we get into are through syndication are 100% funded. So that's what you really want to be looking at, understanding how to syndicate a deal. You can do that by going to the Private Money Bootcamp, which is another one coming up in a couple of months. But you can get the private money. If you can't wait, you can get the Private Money Home Study System. But that's what you really want to do. Private investors will set you free. There's really no source out there that will fund you 100%. And if there is, and they say they will, you got to be really careful because those sources typically don't come through at the end. You've paid them $20,000 or $30,000 up front, and you've got hard money down on the deal, and they walk away a day or 2 days before the closing. I've heard a lot of different horror stories like that. So you're not really looking for 100% financing through an organization. You're looking through you're looking through 100% doing a deal with no money out of your pocket through getting money from primary lenders and also through private money sources. Sometimes you'll find a private money source and they'll be happy to be the only source for you. And that's good. You know, when you find those we call them whales. When you find that whale that wants to fund your deals. And you find them, you got to go through the process of networking. You network through business events, through meetup.com, social events. But it's just a process of networking and, corralling investors, keep putting them on a list, getting commitments, and then following up with them. And then when you get a deal come in, you ask them to raise their hands. Only 50% of them will raise their hand and say that they're ready to invest with you. That's just the way it is. That's the rule of thumb. You know, I've been doing this for 20-something years now, and the rule of thumb is 50% of the people that say they're going to give you money won't when you need it, and of that percentage that will, they're ready to give it to you, another 5-10% will fall out because something happens in their life. So if you need $1 million, you got to have 2-point-something in commitments. If you need $500,000, you need $1 million-point-something in commitments. That's all. You just got to plan ahead. That's where you want to focus. Todd Dexheimer writes in. He says, hey, the market is very heated right now. What is your thought about investing in such a hot market, and where are the best markets with the potential? Well, I talked about where the best markets are, but here's the thing about investing right now, where there's a correction looming somewhere in the future, whether it be 2, 3, 4, 5 years, depending on where you are in the country, it's going to happen. But you know what? If you wait for the correction to happen before you start investing, you are going to miss out on a huge opportunity. The best thing you can do is start investing now, start putting your team together, start putting your systems in place. And then you get 1, 2, 3, maybe you get a bunch of deals. Depends on how strong your relationships are. You put your relationships in place, you get a couple of deals, you understand how the business works. I mean, anything that you read in a textbook, you come to the events, anything that you see, hear, write down, understand, but don't do, it's meaningless until you start doing it. Because when you start doing it, that's when everything starts to really fall, understanding starts falling into place. So that's why you want to have a few deals under your belt before this correction takes place, because when you do and everything's in place, when the correction happens, boom, one correction and really you're set for life. You wouldn't have to do it anymore if you don't want to. Most people get addicted to it, the deal doing, because it's so much fun. But you won't have to. But if you're not prepared and you go into bad deals during the correction, well, after the correction, you get all these different deals, right? You're gonna have 4, 5, 6 different deals that are struggling. And those are the deals that you're just going to focus on. You won't be able to grow your business because you're so concerned about these deals, especially if you have investors' money in the deals. And then you won't be able to prepare yourself for the next correction. It's going to be tough. That's what happened during my first market upside. You get so excited, you're doing a bunch of deals, and all of a sudden, you're doing marginal deals instead of good conservative deals. So you learn those lessons. All right, we're going to take one more, and then we're going to do a live. We're going to go live. What time is it? Okay. What are your thoughts on investing in the Caribbean with stable governments and expanding markets where there are world tourist destinations? For instance, resort areas like Playa de Carmen, Riviera Maya, condos on the ocean, blah, 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 blah. Well, here's the deal. You know, the safest real estate in the whole entire world is real estate within the boundaries of the United States. That's why the whole world is trying to get their money in here. I mean, one of our biggest problems with investing now is the fact that down in South Florida, we've got German money coming in. We've got South American money coming in. You go on the West Coast and you've got Asian money coming in. You know, you go up in New York City and you've got all kinds of European money, Russian money, there's all kinds of money looking to be placed in American real estate because it's safe, especially from countries that are unstable governments, because they're afraid that they're going to take their money. So those people are moving their money into U.S. real estate. So unless you have money to play with, I wouldn't build your empire on investing outside of the United States, but you can certainly build an empire and then start playing around the world with your money if that's what you want to do, because there are certainly good opportunities around the world. But I think you make it here and then you start playing with it after. All right, let's take a live question. Who's next in the Wisecracker line?
Okay, up next we have Fabian. Fabian, please go ahead.
Hi,
Fabian.
Hi, Dave. This is Fabian. How are you?
Good. How's it going?
Good, good. I'm calling from Chicago. I just attended your boot camp in New Jersey and with my wife, Nicole, and we loved it. It was fantastic.
Oh, excellent. Good. I remember when I was on that Skype call, Steve mentioned that there was somebody from Chicago that flew in. It must have been you.
Yeah. Steve was teasing me the whole time I was there. He's a good guy, though.
Yep. So what's going on in your world?
So my question is, I'm coming from a different world, basically been flipping for the last, I don't know, 8-10 years. And I'm a little, I've own some apartment buildings, but nothing bigger than a 15 unit. And I'm a little, just need a little bit of guidance. Looking at a larger building now, about 240 units, and trying to understand as far as when you're doing the financing, even before you even approach the seller and you're trying to put the deal together, how does the seller know that you're good for it? You know, because I mean, you're just doing a letter of intent and then you're just, presenting the deal. So how do they know that you're good for it?
Usually what will happen is there'll be on deals that size, a lot of times, especially in this market, is they'll do best and final. So they'll have like three of the four top offers. And then you'll have seller calls, and you'll actually get on the phone with the seller, and the seller will ask you a series of questions. Before you even get on the phone with the seller, they'll send you over probably 2 pages of questions to answer, and then you'll get on the call with the seller after they've reviewed your answers to those questions, and they'll ask you additional questions. So I think, the biggest mistake that you can make in the seller call, and that's when they started doing these about 4 or 5 years ago, a lot. When I first started doing them, we had probably taken a breather about a year and a half and hadn't done any deals. And I remember when we started doing deals again, and they asked, is your equity ready? And my answer was, well, we've got a lot of different investors. We have over 500 plus investors. We've got a lot of different investors, and we haven't done a deal in about a year and a half, and we've got a lot of dry powder out there. So yeah, they're ready. All I've got to do is present the deal that, where the numbers work in, and it'll come in. Well, that wasn't good enough because I lost the first two deals that I did seller calls with because, I didn't say that the equity was ready. So, that's one of the things that you want to say is the equity is ready. You never want to lie. Your equity should be at least, notified of the deal. You should have equity in place, as you're going forward, or at least partner with somebody that does have the equity that's probably going to be in place in order to make that statement, but just be prepared for that statement.
Okay. Awesome.
Their biggest concern is do you have the ability to perform? So you've
right.
got to answer that question by either giving examples of deals that you've done in the past or partnering with somebody. I mean, you've got a pretty good experience if you've been flipping for a number of years and you've got a couple of smaller ones. It's still not that, it's a big jump to go up to the 200 plus in the potentially the mind of a seller. But if you've got good backing from, I don't know, if you've got a lending institution that's backed you all through the years or hard money lenders that's backed you. But if you've got good backing, you can talk about your backing, you know, and, you know, you can also, you know, state the obvious, you know, the fact that you're moving up from, you know, X amount to this amount, and this is how you prepared for it. And, you know, honesty goes a long way in these calls.
Okay. This particular deal already has a loan in place that still has 6 years on it. And I was talking to somebody else about the deal, and they mentioned that it might make sense to just have the seller pay the prepay on it, because it's got a loan of about $8 million on it, and it's still good for 6 years at like a 5.42 interest rate. But I know somebody had mentioned that maybe it's better to just have them pay the prepay. I don't know, with a deal that big, I don't know if it, you know, if that makes sense.
What's the loan to value right now? With that, because so you're talking about assuming the mortgage. So, what would be the loan to value? And then you'd have to get some secondary debt, or would you think that lender would cover the remainder to bring it up to a loan to value of say 75-80%?
Yeah. So I think right now it's at. Let's see here. Let me just punch the number in real quick. That's 12. So right now it's at a 66. To 70 loan to value. Well, that's based on what he's asking, but I know that they. So here's kind of like a little quick background on the deal. One of the brokers that's working on it is an old friend of mine, and they're kind of stuck a little bit right now in the deal because the current buyer has been nitpicking, and they can't come to a meeting of the minds. And so I have a good idea that they probably will take substantially less, just because this happens to be the smallest property that this owner has out of his portfolio, and he really wants to get rid of it. So, you know, I guess to answer your question, I think, yeah, it's somewhere around, you know, 66 to 70% LTV. Maybe could be a lot less.
All right. So the question as to whether or not it'd be better for the seller just to pay off the penalty, the defeasance, or the yield maintenance, that's going to be a seller answer, you know, as to whether or not they want to take or they would increase the cost of the deal by that amount. That's usually the dynamics of them taking that hit.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have to do the calculations.
And
otherwise,
would it be likely
the lender
would
is.
Tell me- I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, would it be likely that they would be willing to disclose to me what the prepayment penalty would be?
Oh, yeah. You want to know that. You need to know that going in, because you need to know in case something happened to you and your deal, you know, and you had to sell fast, you know, what that would be. So, yeah, that needs to be disclosed. And then you maybe after it's disclosed, you can plan some strategy after that.
Okay.
I'll be happy, you know, after if you get a little deeper into it, I'll be happy to you can call me direct, and I'll be happy to answer your questions on it or plan some strategy. It's not very likely that the seller usually takes the hit unless they're in some sort of a situation where they need to sell, you know, and there's not a lot of buyers out there.
Right.
But, you know, you may make it, you may, you know, create some sort of an offer where it makes sense for them to take it.
Okay.
Also, take a look at the lender. See if the lender is going to give any secondary or subordinated financing, you know, to bring you back up to, say, a 75% loan to value. That might help as well. Unless you have, do you have investors that are right there for you that will be able to take up that slack, that extra deposit?
Well, the broker had mentioned something interesting. He kind of said to me, not really straightforward, but kind of casually said that he thought that the seller might even do some seller financing. So would that be something that would be good?
Yeah. Yeah, that would be good. The bank would still need to you would need to read the loan docs and make sure that it's allowed within the loan document.
Okay. Well, I really appreciate it. I need to do a bit more due diligence and put everything together, and then I can give you a call so I can have everything together.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, welcome aboard.
Thanks.
All right, I got a lot of questions in here about the what was that Ultimate Partnering 9 website. So if you're interested in Ultimate Partnering 9, which happens in the end of July, the last weekend of July, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it's ultimatepartnering9.com. And right now there's an early bird special going on that's about to increase of the price. So ultimatepartnering9.com. You can check it out. Emmett Smith is going to be there. He's going to be our keynote speaker. Matt Romney, the son of Mitt Romney, is going to be there. He's going to talk about how to build a $100 million portfolio. We're going to be educating in all aspects of doing these multifamily and commercial deals. There's going to be great networking. There's going to be speed networking. There's going to be Shark Tank. It's going to be a lot of fun. It is the event of the year in terms of multifamily commercial deals. We'll have about 1,200 people this year. Imagine the contacts that you can make there and the deals that can be funded. All right, let's see. Carl Knox has a question. He says, are there ways I can avoid the risk of losing the cost of a property inspection if the deal falls through? How do you explain this risk to your cash investors? Does whoever risked that money get a bigger cut for taking the risk? Well, you can certainly give somebody a bigger cut for taking the risk of a property inspection, but the first thing you want to do is you want to walk the property yourself. And you want to look for the most common items that, you know, or telltale signs that things are wrong. A swaying roof, you know, says that you've got sheathing problems with your roof. Really green grass in particular areas tells you that you've got plumbing problems underneath the ground. You know, there's on Jeff's, you know, the immersion boot camps that we do probably about 30 times a year in different cities all around the United States. One of the things he does is he walks properties with the students, the group of students that go, and he talks about all the different things that that are telltale signs of what's going on inside of that property or on that property. So you want to be walking that property yourself. You want to act as a potential tenant. You want to get into as many units as you can. And in doing so, you'll be able to get a good feel of what that property needs, you know, and hopefully, you know, you would have put that, you would have dialed that in, as the expression is, you would have dialed that into your offer prior to, and if you hadn't, at least you'd be aware that there's a problem, you know, and of course, you know, when you're acting as a tenant or you're going on the property, I would not only go to the property and act as a tenant, but I would then come after hours when the property manager isn't there, and I would walk the property myself, and I would talk to the tenants, and I would say to them, you know, hey, you know, I'm from, you make any excuse that you want to. I used to say I was from the insurance company. I used to carry a clipboard with me. I'd say, hey, I'm from the insurance company. I'm just checking out the property. Some people say, oh, you're here working off late, huh? And I say, oh, yeah. I say, hey, could I ask you a couple of questions? And I would never knock on anybody's door. I would always catch people either coming out of their cars, sitting in front of their unit, you know. Sometimes I sit on the porch. Sometimes people would look out the window and I wave, and if they wave back, then I would start walking towards them. And people are happy to help. And sometimes I would say, could I come in and see the condition of your property? And they'll invite you in to see the condition of their property. And that will give you an idea. I remember one time I was, where was I? This was a long time ago, down in the South, and somewhere in Atlanta. And I'm walking a property, and this lady says, she says, hey, you. She's up on the third floor. She says, hey, you, what do you do? And she sees me with a clipboard. I said, oh, I'm from the insurance company. They sent me down to walk the property. And she says, oh, she says, you got a funny accent. Where are you from? I said, oh, I'm from Boston. She says, you sent you all the way from Boston? I says, yeah, so I got to get this report done today. You know, we're also going to be upset. Do you mind if I come up and take a look at your unit? She says, no, come on up. So I go in there, right, and her kitchen is not in good shape. And, you know, and there was some chips out of the linoleum flooring in the kitchen and the bath, and the cabinets were in really bad shape. And so I says to her, I says, hey, let me ask you a question. How long have you lived here? She lived there for 16 years. I said, oh, 16 years. I said, you must be in and out of a lot of these different units. You must have a lot of friends here. And she says, I do. I says, let me ask you a question. Are the rest of the units as good a shape as yours? And hers is in rough shape. But I phrased it another way. I said, are they in good a shape as yours? And she says, oh, no. She says, you know, there's units here that are in really rough shape. I thought, oh, my gosh, if she's calling it rough shape compared to hers, it must really be rough. So it gave me a good indication of what was going on there. So don't be afraid to ask questions when you go on site about, are you getting good hot water? You know, how is the electrical? What problems are there on the property? You know, if you could change one thing in this property, what would it be? Ask questions like that. Go on rent.com. Rent.com, put in the property name, and then you'll see what the most common complaints are on rent.com about the property. All right, let's open it up to another live question. Who's next? We're going to go a little bit long today. Usually this call is about an hour, but since we've got some written questions, we've got Civil Success on the line as well, and mastery students asking questions. Let's get another mastery student question. Who's next?
Up next, we have Lena. Lena, please go ahead.
Hi there, Lena? This is Lena from Seattle, Tacoma. How are you?
Good. How's it going?
Going good. Hey, I just want to say I took the immersion training from Jeff, and I thought he was awesome. So, great training. Thank you, Jeff.
That's typically what we hear about that immersion.
Yeah. Hey, my question is, my husband and I are moving at a glacial pace, transitioning from single family into multifamily, and we're getting ready to send one of our nicer properties on the lake. And I have a question about that property. It is listed as a two-story home with X number of square footage. However, my husband and I went in there and we made a second unit down below, really nice with its own deck and, you know, a hot tub inside the deck and all that other stuff. But we only have one electric meter for it. And right now we rent it out to one family and her son. How do I list that? Is it better to list it as two separate properties or open it up again and make it one big family, one single family?
How does the town or city recognize it? Does it recognize it as a multifamily or a single?
Single family.
Then it would have to be sold as a single. You could be sold as a single with an in-law, but I think you might need a variance for an in-law as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, darn. Okay. Okay. And then my second question is, is LP siding a big issue for buyers anymore, or has that kind of died off and people are just starving for properties?
It's kind of died off. I'm not even familiar with the problem. What's the problem with LP siding?
Oh, there was a lawsuit against it, and it was deficient siding. It kind of would crumble apart, the siding.
Oh, is that like the Masonite type of?
Yeah, I believe so. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's I don't know too much of it that's actually still on the side of buildings. One of the things we teach is if you see it, you know, Masonite or texture 111, T111, then you're going to have to reside that property.
Typically. Okay, good to know. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your insight.
You're welcome, Lena. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, who's next?
Okay, up next we have Jose from Texas. Jose, please go ahead.
Hi, Dave.
Jose.
Hi,
Jose
Dave.
Number two.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Another Jose, San Antonio, Texas. Yep, I can. It's probably a little bit of delay.
What's going
on the line
there? Hey, every time I go to San Antonio, I stay at the Menger. You know why?
No.
The Menger Hotel? Because it's haunted.
Really? Okay, not familiar with
it. Yeah.
I've got to check it out.
Alamo. Yeah, it's right next to the Alamo.
I'll check it out.
They got the Teddy Roosevelt bar downstairs. Teddy Roosevelt used to go and hang out there. But yeah, it's haunted. That place is haunted.
Okay.
I've seen things.
All right.
I haven't been the same ever since.
That's good.
What's going
on? I got a question for you. A broker presented me a property which is very unfamiliar for me, and just applying to your knowledge. It's a fractured condominium community, and he is offering 140 units out of a total of 176. And he's mentioning about all the value add opportunity that, you know, with 140 out of 176, you have a lot of leverage. You might be able to, you know, work out something on the HOA side and end up with the full community eventually. That's, he has some 3 and 4 bedroom units that could be converted to 2 bedrooms later on.
All right. I've got your answer.
What are your recommendations?
Don't do it.
Okay.
Don't do it. And the reason is when you have a fractured condo community, you've got fractionalized ownership, and you don't have control over the tenants that your other owners are putting into the property. And that really screws up those deals. So unless you can control all of the units in a property, don't go in and buy a bulk, because you can lose value very quickly from other bad ownership.
Okay.
Not
okay.
A good deal.
Perfect.
Regardless of what they think is the value add. If you're going to buy like an individual one-off here, condo there, and then, you know, hold it for some upside potential in the future, I mean, that would be a single family investment, and that would be, you know, like a spec investment.
Correct.
And that might be okay, but certainly not a property that you're relying on the cash flow.
Okay.
And especially if you're buying a large amount of them, because of what could happen, the risk that are involved.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, Dave. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Jose. All right. Who's next?
Okay. Up next, we have Eric. Eric, please go ahead.
Hey, Dave. It's Eric Gonzalez with Sonder Investments here in San Antonio, Texas as well.
What's going on down there?
We have a beautiful day, and the weather has been
nice.
Are
you walking down that river walk?
About a week.
That river walk down there is beautiful.
I was just down there for the river parade this past Monday, so last week.
Day?
And it was a good time. Yeah, it was beautiful, kind of humid, but it was fun as always. We are actually, that's true. That's very true. We're actually new to the mastery program and just finished our first coaching session with Jackie Hughes.
Yeah.
Super excited to be working with her. It was great. Yeah. She's a personality. I think we clicked pretty well. I have
great.
A question for you. I've been doing some research into a secondary market here, San Marcos. They've had about 2,500 jobs come in within the last 2.5 years and are still in the process of, you know, courting investors and really, you know, changing, turning the city around. My question is, with this courting, I mean, the job influx and corporate relocation has slowed a bit. They don't have as many projections as they did, you know, a year and a half ago. And those companies that have come in, like Amazon, are still in the process of settling. But with this, like, active courting by the city for, you know, new investors and company relocations, does that typically prolong the buyer's two phase, or does it hasten the transition into a seller's one? Because I'm really hoping for, you know, a market that we could spend a few years in.
Well, here's the deal with that market in San Marcos. I used to own the Cedars in San Marcos.
Oh, cool.
We owned that for about 8 or 9 years. Yeah, so I know that market pretty well. It's a college town, in between Austin and San Antonio. And I, you know, I think that whole area, that whole, is it I-30? It goes in between.
I-35.
Yeah. So I think that whole area is going to be an infill area. I think San Marcos is the anchor. And I think the spaces between San Marcos and San Antonio and San Marcos and Austin, you know, in the next 10 or 15 years, it's all going to be filled up. So I think I would be buying in San Marcos still. We sold that property off on a bulk package a couple of years ago. If there was, you know, land that you could put storage on, or just opportunities to be buying things that cash flowed for yourselves in between those areas, I think it's a great buy. I think it's reminiscent of what Orange County was many years ago between LA and Anaheim. You know, people made a ton of money when they were buying up all those orange groves and all that. And I think that that's what's happening right in those two markets. You got Austin, which is always, I mean, there's so many jobs coming into Austin. That's going to spread.
Right.
And then you got San Antonio, which is probably the market that is the most overlooked market in Texas, because all the big investors go to Austin, they go to Houston, they go to Dallas, but they overlook San Antonio, and San Antonio doesn't have the big swings that those markets have. You know, it's just a steady riser. So you're going to see the benefits of that as well. So I like that market, San Marcos. I like that whole area in between there.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Dave. That was very helpful.
You're welcome. All right. Let's go for a couple more questions. I've got another question from Edmund Ogutu. Says, with so many people claiming to be private money lenders, are there any key questions to ask potential lenders to weed out the Nigerian scammers from the true lenders? When looking for investors for down payment money, must one promise a specific percent return on an investor money? What if things go wrong and you can't meet that goal? Well, first of all, you don't guarantee any returns. You can do what's called the preferred return. The preferred return, let's say that you, the investors get like 8%, the first 8% of profits that come in, and then the rest is split with multiple different ways that you can do it. So you never guarantee an investment, but if somebody's going to put down your down payment money, that's going to be probably an equity investor or a sponsor. And, you know, a lot of times what we'll do is the person that brings in the money, Or the money side of it. So there's two sides of a transaction. There's the investor side, which the investors put up the money for the equity, the down payments, and the closing costs. And then there's the what I call the company dollar. So the most typical split is a 60-40, 60% on the investor side, 40% on the company dollar. Inside that 40% on the company dollar, we always take out 25% of that for the people that bring in the money. So of the partners who fill the 25%, they split that. If one person brings in the investor that fills, you know, the 60% over there, they get the full 25% of equity. If multiple people bring it in, then it's all split up. But the remainder 75-25 on the company dollar side gets split between the equity partners in the normal way that it would. So that's typically the way it's done. What are some key questions you can ask private money lenders to make sure that they're not Nigerian scammers, as the as Edmund calls them? Ask them for referrals. You know, the most common scammer response to when you ask for referrals and phone numbers, they'll just say, oh, I'm sorry, that's confidential information. Well, you know, anybody that does good business has a list of people that would be happy to talk to you that would say that this person does good business. So when you ask somebody, you know, could I have a list of people that you've done business with in the past and provided funding for, and they say, I'm sorry, that's confidential, then they're a scammer in most cases, not 100% of the time, but in most cases. All right, let's go to the next live caller. Who's next? Who's next live?
Okay. Up next, we have Suzanne. Suzanne, please go ahead.
Oh, by the way, I just want to say one thing. So for those of you in Silver Success that are now interested in maybe in Mastery, because you're listening to Mastery students ask different questions and doing deals, you can find out more information by calling Jermaine at 781-878-7114. Jermaine or Jeannie, 781-878-7114. They'll be happy to answer any questions. It's not that you're making a commitment to Mastery, but they'll be happy to answer any questions you might have regarding Mastery. And then the Ultimate Partnering website, ultimatepartnering9.com. Go check that out. That's going to be a great event. Okay, who's next?
Hi, this is Suzanne from Seattle.
Hey, Suzanne.
Hey.
How's it going?
So I have a question for you. It's going great. Actually, it's a sunny day out here in Seattle, so I'm super stoked. Normally, we've had some pretty crappy weather lately, but pretty nice to have a sunny day here.
Every time I go to Seattle, it's sunny.
Well,
I must have really good luck.
You have very good luck. So, but it is sunny here more than you think. So, but yeah. So I have a question for you. I came across a deal. It is more of a construction deal. So it's not the fastest path to cash, but it looks like at the end of it, it could have a huge upside. And the folks that are doing it are open to joint venturing. They are developers/contractors. It's on the
yep.
East Coast. They're looking for $6 million for their land and the building. It's basically an old shell. They're looking to put 4 luxury condos in it. Construction costs 12 months at $5.12 million. And at the end, they're looking to get to sell out at $19 million. So there could be an upside of, you know, $5 to $7 million in 12 months. And like I said, they're willing to joint venture. So this is a very tantalizing property, and I'm just wondering what you make of it, or if this is something that you know, I know it's not a half-tenanted multifamily property, but it's, you know, so what's your
the very first step I would take if I was really interested in this property? I thought it was a really good deal. First of all, I would get another partner on my side that understood the deal. For instance, I just had a student call with a really good hotel deal. What he thought was a really good hotel deal, and it looked good to me. I don't really know hotels, but I told him the only way I would do this deal is if I could bring in a partner that knew about hotels, which I did. So in this particular deal, you would bring in a contractor that knows about, you know, how these buildings are built or whatever they're going to do is done. So you don't lose money on the construction aspect of it. Number one, number two, the very first thing I would do is I would get a feasibility study done. If I was really interested, it costs you $7,000 to $10,000, and make sure that that particular site supports whatever they're going to build, that there's a demand there for it.
Oh, great. And the other thing is that all their plans have gone through all the jurisdictions in the city. So everything's been approved.
That's good.
I think that it's expired, so we'd have to re-up it. But they've had everything is actually approved. They've got 2 other projects going right now. They'd like to do this one, but they, you know, kind of like you have to pick the ones that are going to work best for you. So.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Feasibility study. Why did they let this one lapse? That's interesting too. So. I would definitely get the feasibility study done. Maybe they've already done it and ask them for a copy of it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
So yeah, I need to talk to somebody who's got, and it's on the East Coast, so I want somebody back there who's familiar with all the ins and outs. So.
Yep.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. So this is something that I should actually pursue, though.
Well, I mean, if you get the right partners, for sure. I mean, you can call Jeannie. She might know one of our student base that actually has. Oh, actually, we do. There's somebody here in Massachusetts I know that has a building background.
Okay.
So you can contact Jeannie. She could potentially refer you to somebody that might be a good partner. You never know until you partner with them. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Okay.
Awesome. Sounds great. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care. Have a good day. Hey, watch out for that flying fish at the Pike's Fish Market, huh?
All right. I'll duck.
All right. All right. We've got time for one more because I've got a meeting at 2:30. So who's our last caller? Who is it?
Okay. We have Mike. Mike, please go ahead.
Good morning. How you doing, Dave?
Hey, Mike, what's going on? You must be from the West Coast.
Yeah, I'm out in Phoenix. Not quite the West Coast, but they keep telling us someday when the big one hits, we will be West Coast. But I'm not waiting. I'm not waiting for that time for my properties to value go up. I just have a question for you. We have a really good Real Estate Investors Association here, and they provide market charts as to what's going on a monthly basis, but they're all based on single family. One of the questions I have is they do rent increases and where the rents are going in single family. How does that relate to typically what that would look like for apartments? Are apartments typically a little less than a single family rent than a price per square foot?
It usually lags it by a bit, by about 6 months or so. Are you talking about Al Langston's group, AZ RIA?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You know, he's got multifamily information as well. I remember before I did a presentation there, the last time I was there a few years ago, he put multifamily numbers together, and it was showing that Phoenix for the first time was moving after a number of years. And I was even surprised by the numbers that he put up there. So I think if you asked him, if you're a member of that group, if you just sent him an email or asked him, I'm sure he'd be happy to supply you with those numbers.
Yeah, and we have the meeting coming up next week. And I know that he's going to be doing the multifamily for this meeting because of his guest speaker.
Who's the guest
coming
speaker?
In this time? Do you know Anthony Chara?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, he's going to be talking about investing in multifamily.
He'll give you some great information because that's what he did. That's what he did for me when I was going to speak about multifamily. So you should be get some great information.
I saw you when you were out here. That's when I first saw you. I attended you did a Saturday class, and unfortunately, I wasn't smart enough to invest with you at that time. I waited until the beginning of this year. Missed a lot of opportunity.
The best part about life is that it's forgiving. And
true.
Now's a good time to get started. Best time to get started is now.
That's true. All right. I was just curious about that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay, everybody, that's going to wrap it up. A couple of things. Number one, for your homework, you got to go out there and you got to get yourself into two networking situations so you can be getting people on your committed list for funding. And also put in two offers. Doesn't have to be two good deals, but just put in two offers so you can be talking to a broker. You can get to the next level of conversation so you can get experience and confidence. Because if you simply just do two and two, you cannot help but be successful. Simple as that. If you're interested, if you're a Silver Success and you're interested in mastery, call 781-878-7114. Jeannie and Jermaine will be able to help you out there. Ultimate Partnering 9, the early bird special is going up. So it's ultimatepartnering9.com. Go check that out. And that was our first experience with live stream. So here I am to say over and out. Everybody in the tech crew did a great job. Great job. Woo! All right. Success. Come on over here. This is the tech crew right here. This is Alex. Alex has got to put this all together, plus the two guys in the other room, Chris over there and Tyler. Thank you. All right. Bye, everybody.